I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. In the cover story in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine, ProPublica reporter Alec McGillis chronicles the strained relations between Baltimore police and impoverished communities since the 2015 uprising and the subsequent crime wave that has only recently begun to abate. The prevalence of violence, drugs, and despair isn't unique to Baltimore. It's an American story of urban blight rooted in the disenfranchisement of people of color from segregation, redlining, and economic isolation. But some other cities seem to be making more progress than us. What is the prescription for hope here? Alec McGillis joins me to talk about his provocative article, The Tragedy of Baltimore. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Dinner with Friends at the Everyman Theater. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us on this rainy Monday. At least it's rainy where we are here in Baltimore. Last night, there were four shootings in our city that left two young men dead. This kind of news is, of course, not uncommon, but has the frequency of this kind of news made us inured to its horribleness? Last week, a long piece in the New York Times Magazine landed with a thud in the inboxes of people all around Baltimore. A huge buzz had begun about a provocative and piercing look at our city since the violence and uprising that coursed through the streets 4 years ago after the death of Freddie Gray while in the custody of the Baltimore City Police Department. Last Sunday, the piece appeared as the cover story in the print edition of the Times Magazine, replete with pictures of crime scenes and families that had been afflicted by the violence that has become all too commonplace in many of our neighborhoods. The story paints a grim picture of our hometown. The cover is emblazoned with a title that is depressing and sobering: How an American City Falls Apart, The Tragedy of Baltimore. My guest today is the award-winning reporter who wrote this story. Alec McGillis covers politics and government for ProPublica. He was part of a team that won a Pulitzer Prize when he was working at the Baltimore Sun. In 2016, he won the Toner Prize for Excellence in Political Reporting. In addition to the New York Times, his work has been featured in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and several other national publications. He also wrote a biography of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He lives here in Baltimore, and I'm proud to say that he's been a guest on our program several times. Welcome back, Alec. Good to see you.
Thanks, Tom.
So, listeners, what do you think? Is our city falling apart? Are the problems that we face substantially different from the challenges faced by other cities? Did the 4 million plus subscribers to the New York Times get an accurate picture of where we are today and where we've been in the past? We'd love to hear from you. You are welcome to join our conversation with Alec McGillis at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at midday. WIPR. You can also ping us on the WIPR Facebook page. We are streaming from Studio A. So, Alec, the first thing I want to make sure folks know is that this is not the kind of thing where the New York Times assigns you a piece and you're some guy from New York who helicopters in and writes a story. You've lived here for a while.
Yes, I have. I've lived here for 11 of the last 18 years. I was a reporter at The Sun in the first half of the aughts, and then I moved back here with my family 5 or 6 years ago, missed Baltimore a lot, and we came back. And we live here. My kids go to public school here. I love the city. I'm very involved in the city. I do a lot of tutoring around town. I've been doing some community trash pickups around town of late that I've been enjoying with friends and neighbors. And basically, this piece, in a way, was an odd one for me to take on because I have been an incredible booster for the city, to the point of being sort of made fun of by folks, how much I try to, you know, support the city and get people to move here and all that. But I decided to take the piece on despite that because I was just really disconcerted by what I saw happening the last few years. Not only the homicide surge that we've experienced, so that was the main thing that just was breaking my heart to see this happening every day after day, but just this more general sense of an unraveling in the city.
So you took a year to report this story.
More than a year.
And what did you have particular questions you set out to answer when you started?
Yes. Above all, the main question was, what is behind this horrific homicide surge? We've always had obviously a problem with violence in the city, but it got way worse in the last few years. I did the math recently. We've lost more than 400 people in the city in the last 4 years, over and above what the average is of the 7 years prior. So 400 people died in the last 4 years, more than one would have expected under a sort of, you know, what was normal in the city. So that was my main question. What has caused this surge? And then beyond that, I was also trying to figure out what is behind this more general unraveling, this general sense of a kind of institutional breakdown in the city, to the point where it felt almost as if there was nobody in charge.
Is it an unraveling of the city, or is it a specific problem in specific neighborhoods? Because there's plenty of neighborhoods, yours and mine included. Mine perhaps a little less than yours. I live in Reservoir Hill. You're in Medfield or
Evergreen.
Evergreen. There are plenty of neighborhoods that see almost no violence. You know, I mean, it's violence and the crime and the murders are happening as they have always happened in, you know, four or five zip codes, not the entire city. Is it a matter of policing and the problems we've had with the police? That's one thing. Why do you think that indicates a general unraveling of the city writ large?
Well, it's not an unraveling of the city writ large. It's an unraveling of order and governance in the city. That's the key. I made clear in the piece that economically the city's actually doing relatively okay. If you compare Baltimore with a lot of other post-industrial cities, you know, that have gone through hard times, it looks pretty good in a lot of metrics of income and wealth, and even actually African-American income and wealth compared to a lot of other cities. What the unraveling really has to do with order and governance. We are off the charts with violence compared to other cities. I mean, if you look at, you know, compared to Detroit, New Orleans, Cleveland, Philly, other cities with violence problems, we're so far beyond them now. We're basically the only city in the country that has returned to early 1990s levels of violence. That's just extraordinary. And yes, it's concentrated, as we know, in certain parts of town. Whole swaths of town. If you look at the map of where the homicides are, but there has been, beyond those concentrated homicides, there has definitely been a broader sense in the city of an unraveling of order that comes with other sorts of crimes. We have seen an increase also in robberies and burglaries and carjackings and all those sorts of crimes that are more widely spread across the city. And then it's also a sense of just kind of an institutional unraveling. It's not just that we've seen a surge in crime, it's that the police department seem to be falling apart the last few years with this extraordinary corruption case that unfolded in court last year with the Gun Trace Task Force case, the musical chairs of commissioners, one commissioner after another, more than one commissioner a year, basically, the last few years. And then this also the sense of real dysfunction in City Hall, and a sense of a really kind of a crisis in governance generally in the city. So it's not about economics; it's about order and governance.
What's the crisis in City Hall?
Well, the crisis in City Hall has been above all an inability to deal with the surge in violence. I mean, that's what you've seen. This is not just about the current administration in City Hall. This goes back some ways now. You had one thing, of course, if you look at the history of recent administrations, you had one mayor, Sheila Dixon, who actually did manage to get the homicide rate under 200, which was remarkable, back in 2011. She then leaves after being convicted on various corruption ethics related charges, and is replaced by Stephanie Rawlings Blake, who got some things done for our city. But then after one key moment in our recent history that I wish the piece that could have gotten into in more depth is what happened after the Freddie Gray's death and the protests and the unrest, where there was really a kind of a remarkable I don't know if abdication might be too strong a word, but Mayor Rawlings Blake really kind of was not so visible in the year or two that followed, the remainder of her term. She decided not to run for office again. We had a very long lame duck period there. And then Catherine Pugh comes in 2016, and so you have a new mayor coming in, and it just became clear quite quickly just how much she was struggling to get her arms around this violence problem. It took quite a while for a sort of a comprehensive plan to emerge to address that. And so we've had this sustained surge. It's no longer a spike. It's a sustained surge in violence that no one has been able to get their arms around. And then, of course, the dysfunction in City Hall has taken on other forms, too, as we've been seeing this week. There's just a constant sense of almost of crisis around our government to the point where the average citizen is left thinking, who is running my city? Who is in charge here? Is there anybody in charge?
Yeah, there's certainly a crisis this week with Mayor Pugh's involvement in this scandal involving the University of Maryland Medical System Board of Directors and payments to her and other board members and stuff. I'm not sure I buy the notion that there's been a constant state of crisis at City Hall since her election in 2016. But that aside, you make a statement in the piece that I was intrigued by, and you say that the national political discourse lacks a vocabulary for the city's ills. What do you mean by that?
Well, this was one of the things that really motivated me to do this piece. The sense that very few people around the country seemed to be aware of what was happening here. There was of course, the whole world's media came to the city for the protests and the unrest and the rioting, whatever one would like to call it, following Freddie Gray's death. We had this entire world here watching that unfolding. But after that, it's been remarkable to me how little attention there's been to the sustained violence that has followed followed that moment in time. How little attention there was to this incredible police corruption case that we had here, and it really seemed as if there was one reason for that sort of lack of attention to the violence we've had here, is that it didn't really fit the prevailing national narrative around policing and police reform. There's been this whole debate over how do we reform policing in this country so that we have fewer of these awful shootings of unarmed black men and boys and other forms of police excessive policing. And that is a very good and necessary debate we're having. But what was happening here in Baltimore the last few years was sort of overlooked by that whole debate, and which is I find unfortunate, because actually I really believe that what's been happening here could actually be fit into the debate, progressives concerned about social justice could also have reckoned with what's been happening here, because it is in itself represents itself a form of discrimination and negligence by the authorities. It just takes the form of a kind of not of excessive policing, but a kind of pullback by the police that is in its own way problematic. It's just unfortunate that what's been happening here has not gotten that much notice nationally, because it just didn't fit into it wasn't seen to fit into the debate around policing reform.
The notice that it's getting, what's the next thing after the notice? Because now there's 4 million plus subscribers who potentially could read this piece. I mean, obviously people here in town, I think a lot of people's reaction was, well, this is all stuff I knew, because they're here and they do hear about the Gun Trace Task Force, and they certainly heard about Freddie Gray, and they've certainly heard about the consent decree and Michael Harrison and the optimism that has accompanied his appointment. But so now that the nation knows more about it, to what end, do you think?
Well, my hope would be that the piece has cause people to think more carefully and deeply about policing, and to consider the fact that in communities like West and East Baltimore, the problem is not only one of excessive policing, police harassing people, police using excessive force, but that there can also be sort of the flip side problem of police negligence and police. Basically,
and not enough police.
Not enough policing.
Not enough policing. Yeah.
Police allowing people to do violence to other people in the community to get away with it, and thereby allowing a sense of impunity to set in, and allowing things to spiral out of control. And because that is what we've been seeing here. And to recognize that that in itself is its own form of discrimination, its own form of the authorities not providing equal protection to people. Equal protection means not only that you avoid harassing people in one community and not another, that you treat people the same way that in that form, but it also means that you provide protection as you would in another part of town.
We've got to take a break, but let's go to one call before we do that. Let's go to Bob in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Alec McGillis.
Thank you. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks. The article talked about a lot of the violence, as you've mentioned. But my question is, 10 years ago, there was a decrease in violence. And this was due, I worked in the school system then, to an unusual collaboration between the police, city government, the health department, schools, and very importantly, community advocates. And that does not seem to be happening now. I'd like to hear your guest comment on possible solutions with that kind of collaboration. Thank you.
That's a very good point, Bob. One of the things that I came across in my reporting is that when I was trying to figure out what was going right in the years where we got the rate down somewhat, or got it down quite a bit, was that there was all this coordination going on between relevant agencies. As you mentioned, the schools, the health department, one very crucial collaboration that I, you know, came across was all this coordination going on between the police department, the state's attorney's office, and state agencies.
Are you talking about the O'Malley administration in the early 2000s?
This is O'Malley, but then also the Dixon administration. This is basically...
Because the mayor, of course, would say, well, wait, I have a meeting every day, every morning at 8 o'clock with the police department, the health department, the transportation department, the people who change the light bulbs.
No, this is about the state. What was crucial was that it was the state agencies. And all these key agencies that we think of as police-related agencies are actually state agencies. Parole and probation, juvenile services, corrections, state police, those are all state agencies. And under Governor O'Malley, there was all this pressure coming from the Governor O'Malley on these state agencies to coordinate as much as they possibly could with the city. And it was partly in his own self-interest. He was the governor, and he was from Baltimore. He wanted to make sure the crime rate in Baltimore stayed lower. He was thinking of running for president. This was in his political interest to try to keep the rate, you know, declining in Baltimore. So for instance, parole and probation, so crucial. He put all his pressure on parole and probation to help the police in going after those 100 guys that were most likely to engage in violence or be victims of violence, to be constantly knocking on the door, making sure they're, you know, complying with the terms of their parole and probation. If they weren't, they were going to go back behind bars. And that fell away after Governor O'Malley left office. There was Governor Hogan and who was then the commissioner then, Anthony Batts. They both acknowledged that there was much less cooperation between the two of them. They'll, of course, each blame the other for that fact. But there was this real breakdown in coordination that was happening in the years when things were better.
Yeah, we got to take a break. But it's interesting because, you know, there's so much blame to go around and so many people who've been, you know, targeted for the blame. Of course, Mayor O'Malley, Governor O'Malley, when he was a presidential candidate in particular, was accused of being the reason that the relationship between the police and communities of color in particular deteriorated because of the so-called, you know, broken windows, zero tolerance policing. We'll talk about all that when we come back. Alec McGillis covers politics and government for ProPublica, and we're talking about the cover story he wrote for the New York Times Magazine, The Tragedy of Baltimore. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet @midday WYPR, to send me a tweet. I am a twit. You can send me a tweet @TomHallWYPR. You can also ping us on the WYPR Facebook page. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's the Midday News Wrap. Baltimore Sun investigative reporter Luke Broadwater joins me with the latest on the Healthy Holly scandal that has surrounded Mayor Catherine Pugh and which has raised a lot of questions about contracting practices at the University of Maryland Medical System. We'll also have an update from Annapolis in the General Assembly. We'll look at some of the bills that survived crossover day. That happened on Monday. And we'll do that with WIPR Statehouse reporter Rachel Bay and the Baltimore Sun's Pam Wood. Plus, the first ever Old Time Music Festival is taking place this weekend at the Creative Alliance, and we'll hear from one of the bands that's performing. The Local Honeys will join me with their distinctive harmonies live right here in Studio A. That's coming up tomorrow. By the way, speaking of Annapolis, today is the first day of the Annapolis Film Festival. More than 80 films from nearly 30 countries will be screened today through Sunday at various locations in Annapolis. We'll have a link to more information about it at wypr.org/midday. And coming up later today, J. Wynn Russick will review Dinner with Friends. That's the new show at the Everyman Theater. But if you're just joining us, my guest is the ProPublica reporter Alec McGillis. He's the author of the provocative cover story in last week's New York Times Magazine called The Tragedy of Baltimore, How an American City Falls Apart. To join us, our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And you can ping us on the WIPR Facebook page. Let's go to the phones to David in Baltimore. David, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I don't want to talk about stuff. I'm going to really try hard to be succinct. And the way I see Baltimore failing is from a landlord perspective, someone that works with housing. What I found is the city's favorite move is to force all the risk and expense onto landlords. So recently there was a vote that is forcing landlords to accept Section 8 voucher holders. The problem I have with this bill is that there's been zero talk about how horrible and slow that program works, how hard it is to work with. There's been no talk about how to look at the fundamental problems of why people are on the voucher program to begin with. It's really basically 100% just ways for the city to threaten, fine, and cause an incredible amount of anxiety onto landlords.
Well, David, what in your mind is the link between people who have housing vouchers and violence?
The housing vouchers and violence?
Yes.
I don't know if there's much of a link there,
okay,
actually.
So let's establish that. And people with housing vouchers and who are in the Section 8 program, affordable housing is an issue for a lot of folks who aren't making a whole lot of money. I mean, if you are renting an apartment to somebody and you're getting paid, whether you're getting paid through the Section 8 program or from directly from the tenant, why does it matter so much?
Sure. Can I please respond?
Sure.
I'll give you a real easy example. When I have a turnover, my turnover average is 5 days or less. If I'm forced to work with the Section 8 program, the bureaucracy is so slow, it can take them up to 2 months just to inspect the house. So I would have to lose several thousand dollars just waiting for that program to run efficiently.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the perspective. It's not exactly the topic that we're talking about because we are talking about the epidemic of violence, but I do appreciate that perspective from David. We have an email from Barbara Alec, who says, I was disappointed in the article. It wasn't investigative. There was nothing in it that anybody who generally follows local news wouldn't know. There was no analysis of why the breakdown of police in the city came about as opposed to the fact that it did. It's just a sorry tale of this happened and then that happened. I would take issue with Barbara there, Alec, and that you do try to figure out why it is that crime spiked. And one of the things that you report with pretty solid assuredness, and it's something that I was unable to get people to say to me on the record over the years when I've talked about this, I think in particular of Kevin Davis, the former police chief, when it came to this notion of the police so-called taking a knee. And I did talk to Michael Harrison, the new commissioner, about this on Tuesday, and I was interested when he was on our show that he sort of acceded the point. He said that, you know, it was his impression that people, in fact, were, you call it a pullback. What's the relationship between the pullback and the spike in crime? Is there a direct lineage?
One of the things that really struck me in reporting this piece was, in fact, how accepted it was and how open people were across the board in the city about the pullback, that, that it was a, basically an historical fact that this happened. So while people have been sort of wary of admitting this all these last few years, now it's gotten to the point where it's basically an accepted fact. So you had former police commanders, police officers, activists, really across the board, people acknowledging that this happened. And so, you know, what happened immediately following Freddie Gray's death and the protests and the unrest was that you had this pullback. You had police officers who were aggrieved, above all, about the charges that were brought by the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, against six of their colleagues in Freddie Gray's death. And also aggrieved at their leadership, department leadership, for the way that they handled their unrest on April 27th.
And everybody just assumed that that was happening, but the police and the mayor and other people were reluctant to say, yeah, that's really going on, as you can imagine why.
Yes.
But I mean, the folks that you talk to are assuring you. I mean, you are absolutely certain that police are reluctant to do their job because they feel constrained by the consent decree, and they just don't want to get charged by the state's attorney.
Well, it wasn't the consent decree yet. The consent decree came later. So it really was aggrievement over the charges above all. It was, we're upset that you've charged these. This is the key. They were upset that officers know who the sort of, you know, bad officers are in their department. They know who the corrupt officers are, the ones who would be charged eventually in the Gun Trace Task Force case. What they were upset about was that the state's attorney was charging these other six officers who they saw as sort of regular, decent, you know, workaday officers who were being charged in a case where there were still all sorts of questions over what had actually happened that caused the tragic death of Freddie Gray. And so they react to this, their aggrievement over this and bewilderment, by basically saying, look, we'll show you life in town without us. And so arrests plunged. That's a quantifiable fact. And you basically then had a situation where it was possible for a crew to take a new corner, or someone to settle a score against someone else, for someone to walk out the door with a gun intending to do someone else harm, with much less fear of being caught. And this is the key. It's all about consequence and your fear of consequence. And this is not just about Baltimore. This is something that, you know, in the history of the world, when there is no law, or when there's a perception of there being no law, people will take the law in their own hands.
Yeah, the commissioner the other day phrased it. He said it's the severity. We're concentrating on severity instead of the certainty. He said it's the certainty that's the deterrent. It's not mandatory minimums, you know, whether it's 3 years or 5 years for this crime or that crime, doesn't matter. It's the certainty that you're going to get caught, that the crime is going to be cleared, and that you're going to pay some consequences.
Right.
We have an email from Mark who says our albatross is City Hall. The people of Baltimore are decent, hardworking, and as smart as anybody. And then there's Holiday Street, where the lack of ethics, the lack of leadership, and the lack of honesty is unfathomable. And again, when the mayor is ensconced in this kind of, you know, local scandal of this week, it's gonna taint people's opinion about how she's able to act on a number of other fronts. I had Michael Braverman, who's the city's housing commissioner, here yesterday, and I asked him about this piece that you wrote and what he thought about it. And he said that, you know, he doesn't contest any of the facts that you reported and the history that you chronicled, but he himself is much more optimistic when he looks at certain neighborhoods where the housing supply is getting better, where the quality of housing is going up, where more people are moving in and neighborhoods are stabilizing. He has a much more rosy, optimistic picture. You say that it takes enormous fortitude, and I'm not quoting you directly here, but you say it's a formidable task to be optimistic about the city of Baltimore.
I would say two things. First of all, that I am, in fact, optimistic. I don't, in fact, as dark, you know, a light as this piece cast on the city at this moment in time, I don't believe that things are beyond hope. There's so many people that care a lot about the city. The city has so much going for it that I do not think it's beyond hope. I'm all in. I'm not going anywhere, and I'm gonna, you know, keep doing what I can as a citizen to fight for the city. I do believe that that one thing it's going to take for the city to get beyond this moment is good governance. There's so many of the people that have sort of responded to my piece by arguing that, well, you know, there's all these good groups doing this and that, and there's all these efforts doing this and that in this neighborhood and that neighborhood. That's great. That really is great. And I'm part of some of those efforts. But what matters above all is governance. It's about City Hall. And that you just can't make up for a sense of a void. You can't make up for a void and a sense of dysfunction in City Hall. That matters so much. There's one thing my piece.
So what specifically would you mayor do?
Well, I would say, one thing the piece points out is that the city has city government has lost some people in the last couple of years that have moved on. And they didn't just move on because they wanted to do the other job. They moved on because they were finding it hard to work in City Hall. And I've just heard in my reporting, heard a lot about how hard good people were finding it to work in City Hall, and some good people are still in City Hall, and that's great, and they're doing really good work, like your guest yesterday, Michael Braverman, but other good people have left, and other good people are finding it really hard to do their job,
But that, you know, that's the case in any organization, isn't it? I mean, on the one hand, I mean, we had a person like Lena Nguyen, who is a terrific health commissioner. She gets this very interesting and unique opportunity to head Planned Parenthood. I mean, that's a tough call for her in terms of her career. And I don't know why she left, but I'm sure part of the reason was that it was a good job. I think of the city solicitor, Andre Davis, who's a Fourth Circuit federal judge. He had a very, very prestigious career, and he's come back to work in the city of Baltimore. This is where he grew up, and he wants to make a difference. I mean, there are some very talented people in the administration, in this current administration. I guess what it comes down to, and my pushback here is done from the premise of what is the capacity of Catherine Pugh or Michael Harrison or Marilyn Mosby to stop the kind of violence that is endemic in certain neighborhoods. I mean, almost 90% of the people who were killed last year had arrest records, and half of those had prior arrests for violent crimes. 19% of the people who were killed last year were shot the year before, or shot previously, and just didn't die of their wounds. And this time, tragically, they did. I mean, the cops can't be in every living room where a fight breaks out, or on every street corner where people are wielding guns looking to do harm.
But that's a very fatalistic way to look at it. The fact is that just a few years ago, many fewer people were dying in the city, and because certain things were being done better. And so there are things that can be done. And this piece was partly an attempt to look at what those things were that were being done better just a few years ago, and to show that, in fact, basic bureaucratic steps, basic personnel steps actually do make a difference. And to simply throw up our hands and say, you know, this is the way it's always been in the city is terrible, because it's not the way it's always been. Just we've always had violence, but again, we've lost 400 more people in the city in the last 4 years than would have been expected. And that's just not acceptable.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, I'm not necessarily suggesting we throw up our hands, but I just wonder what sort of culpability we can ascribe to various political figures. But it's a very good point. We have an email from Alex, and this is to a point that you made earlier. Violence and crime in the city is a direct result of resources being distributed unevenly, coupled with gentrification and policing. He mentions the current legislation in Annapolis about the Johns Hopkins police force, private police force, and he says it puts residents of color in Charles Village and Station North and Remington at risk. This is a key step in the gentrification of the city. It will lead to increased police violence, incarceration, and homelessness. So again, this is people, you know, often in the progressive camp who just are suspicious of policing in general.
So, you know, I didn't get into the Hopkins policing debate in the article. There's so many things I just couldn't get into with the space allowed. And I have my own questions about how the Hopkins force is going to work, just how it seems like there's going to be all constant sort of overlap issues and territorial issues when you have this force in so many different parts of the city, because Hopkins is kind of everywhere in the city. But to the basic point that simply having more police out there is going to be inevitably going to be a problem, that is not what I was hearing in the time I was spending around town. And one of the key things that I hope my piece gets across is that a lot of people in West Baltimore and East Baltimore and Park Heights and Southwest Baltimore are feeling so unsafe now and so scared unable to leave their home, feeling just locked down at night, that they desperately want more protection. I went to those hearings that the new commissioner was having around town, his forums, nine of them. I went to three of them.
I went to one.
And I went to in Reservoir Hill, at Douglas, and down in Evanston Village. And I, 8 out of 10 people were getting up to talk about their fear.
I heard the same thing.
And, and one after another, these forums were crowded.
Yep.
And that's the reality. And that doesn't mean that, that people want to return to the days of zero tolerance and harassment and all that, but it means that they want protection. They want equal protection.
Yeah. You say that justice and freedom don't have to be mutually...
Justice and order.
And order don't have to be mutually exclusive. Let's see if we can sneak in another call from Ellen, who calls us from Baltimore County. Welcome to Midday with Alec McGillis.
Hi. I don't even know that I have much to say. I'm new to this area. I live in the 21204 zip. And I guess I think I've totally confused or confounded your screener, but somehow she thinks I should say something. I just feel that it seems to be systemic what's going on here. There's such bias, and I've certainly lived, I'm 250 years old, I mean, not quite, but, and I've lived in a lot of different places, but I'm just so uncomfortable all the time with the kind of pervading atmosphere of, I don't know. I feel education is really the key to a lot of things, and
I think a lot of people share your discomfort, and that's, again, a perception thing. And one of the scenes that you put in your article is a scene that resonated with me because I've had the same interaction with Mayor Pugh when you talked to her about this and the perception of violence run amok in the city. She shows you her phone with the statistics that say they're on the way down, and she's right. They are on the way down, but they are not by any means being reduced in any sort of significant way.
Well, to the caller's point about the systemic causes, including education in our, you know, our inadequate schools and all that, it's absolutely true that we have all these systemic causes that have driven violence in the city for years. But the fact is that not so long ago, half as many people were being killed, and we had all the same systemic issues then as well. And so I'm hesitant, while we need to address all the systemic causes if we're ever going to really get the city healthy and moving in the right direction. And I'm, you know, all for that. We can't simply sort of rationalize the violence by pointing only to the systemic causes. The fact is that we just not that long ago, despite our systemic problems, we managed to get violence down quite a bit.
Trish has an interesting observation on Facebook. I think it's quite interesting that on the one hand, Baltimore is a leader in gentrification, while also having the reputation of having such a large murder rate. And there's been some research about that just this week. The Washington Post, the Baltimore Sun had some stuff about that. There are, you know, a number of pockets of gentrification going on here in Baltimore. And of course, with gentrification comes sometimes displacement and problems. On the other hand, gentrification also brings stability to neighborhoods.
Yeah, I looked at that very interesting report this week on gentrification in American cities. And the thing that jumps out at you about Baltimore is that while the city has experience high rates of gentrification as they defined it, the gentrification in the city has been almost entirely in its white neighborhoods. In the working class white neighborhoods of South Baltimore, Southeast Baltimore, Hamden, those are the neighborhoods that have experienced extraordinary gentrification of you know, new higher income residents moving in and displacing lower income residents. There's been strikingly little gentrification in Baltimore in our historically deprived African American neighborhoods.
We're running out of time, but I did get a few emails from folks with some pushback to your piece. One is the president of the T. Rowe Price Foundation, another is the president of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and another is with the Open Society Foundation's U.S. program. And they note, for example, that graduation rates, test scores, and property values in Baltimore is up. They say the city is ahead of its peers in drug diversion and community-oriented policing programs. People are very optimistic about Michael Harrison, the new police commissioner, and they're basically saying our history of innovation and connectedness, according to them, will continue to make it a model for solutions to urban problems around the world. So there are people who are very high on the city of Baltimore.
Well, again, I have some optimism that we can get beyond this moment. But a lot of the things that people are pointing to in response to my piece do not actually have to do with the problems of order and governance. The number that I think we really have to focus on, and because that's really the sort of the, you know, the core number here of how people actually feel about our city and how it's going is population. And we were gaining population just a few years ago, which was remarkable. And we've now started dropping population quite dramatically just in the last few years as the violence has surged. And I have a, you know, a really bad feeling that the next numbers we're going to see are going to be pretty ugly.
Alec McGillis is an award-winning journalist for ProPublica. He is the author of The Cynic, a 2014 biography of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. And we've got a link to his piece about Baltimore in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine on our website, wypr.org/midday. Alec, we have to leave it there. I appreciate it. We'll see you soon.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up after a break, theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins me with her review of Dinner with Friends at the Everyman Theater. It's Midday, and I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.